Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Executive Counselor Andrew Walensky is one of two Democrats running in this year's gubernatorial primary. An attorney, Walensky says he wants to lower Granite Staters' property taxes, and he's refused to take the so-called pledge, the promise to veto any broad-based sales or income tax. For the first part of this program, we'll speak with Walensky about these and other positions he's taken ahead of the September 8th primary. And you can weigh in with your questions now. You can send them by email. Our address is exchange@nhpr.org. The quickest way to get a question to Counselor Walensky is to give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Andrew Walensky, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Peter.
Let's start with school reopening plans. That's on the minds of a lot of parents, students, and teachers right now. In your school reopening plan, you say districts should plan to end in-person instruction in late October, using the early part of the school year to focus on social and emotional learning and preparing kids to go remote in the winter. But districts across the state are all creating their own plans. Some are all in-person. Some are starting remote with a plan to go in-person later. Should this decision be left to districts to decide, or should the governor order a statewide mandate?
Well, look, I have 30 years of commitment to public education. I know the school buildings that we have in our state. There are 488 of them. Many of them are just not equipped to open. I know the funding sources. Many school districts cannot afford the additional costs to reopen. I know the teachers. The state's largest teacher union, the NEA, 17,000 members just endorsed me. With that background, I think it's fair to say that Sununu and Edelblue made a complete hash of reopening. They listened to Betsy DeVos's consulting firm and didn't listen to the New Hampshire Task Force. At one time, 2 weeks ago, we published an op-ed that explained my approach to reopening. There are so many uncertainties now that I'm not sure we can reopen on a typical schedule of late August, early September. It may be that we do need to stay remote through a point in October when we have a better sense of what's happening with the COVID virus. So I don't think the governor should have made a blanket order. I think the governor should have set minimum standards, provided concrete guidance, and provided resources so that schools could evaluate their own capabilities, like with their air conditioning, air exchange systems. Mm-hmm. All the governor said about that, all Edelblue said about that was, evaluate your system. That's an
with respect to the air quality, you mean?
Yeah. Look, there's an engineering standard. It's pretty clear the air needs to turn over 2.5 times an hour in your classrooms. Mm-hmm. Well, how many of our buildings meet that? We don't know. And there were no resources provided by the state to help school districts determine whether they even meet that basic concrete objective standard.
Though some would argue that aside from the air quality issue you just mentioned, that the governor has provided a lot of leeway for districts to evaluate their resources and decide for themselves whether or not to go in to school in person or just stay remote or do some kind of hybrid. Are you saying that was the right approach, or should the state have created sort of a one-size-fits-all situation?
No, the state should have provided the resources so that the communities could do the evaluation. Just saying you're on your own is not leadership. And that's what Edelblue and Sununu did. That's a failure of leadership.
So would you have provided more funding for schools to reopen? Is that primarily what you were after?
funding and guidance. So that 2.5 times an hour standard, that engineering standard, it's nowhere in the guidelines. I only know that because I talked to school personnel and heating engineers about the subject. There is not a single guideline in that 50-page document drafted by Betsy DeVos's consulting firm. Mm-hmm. They totally abdicated leadership. That's a real problem, and that's not what I would do as governor.
With all this remote learning about to happen, how concerned are you about widening the education gap and students falling behind?
It's a huge concern. It's the idea that we went into remote learning with no notice. Sunday afternoon, Edelblue announced schools would not open on Monday morning. That was a travesty and should not have happened. We happened to have had a governor and council meeting the preceding Wednesday. And I said to Sununu, you're going to need to close schools. What's the plan? And Sununu said he just talked to Mike Pence. This was a flu. There was no need to close schools. Again, another abdication of leadership by Sununu. So there is a diversity in ability to respond to remote learning. Some places in our state don't even have reliable broadband. So it's hard just to do access. But beyond that, it's hard for some families to sit down with their children, to offer the level of supervision that's needed to supplement the remote learning that's being offered by the teachers at school. We really need to get our arms around how we bridge this gap in a way that doesn't leave any of our children, any of our families behind. You know, this is just another aspect of the Claremont problem that I've been working on for 30 years. There is such a distinct difference between districts that have lots of resources and districts that do not. It's an economic justice issue. You can't leave broad swaths of our school population out of the opportunities for advancement that good schools provide.
Listeners, we're speaking with executive counselor and Democratic candidate for Governor Andrew Walensky. If you've got a question for him, give us a call now, 1-800-892-6477. You referenced the Claremont decisions. Those were the lawsuits where you were the lead counsel pushing to get the state to fund what the state has considered an adequate education. The state still has trouble doing that. How would you, as governor, make sure that the state does fund what the state constitution calls an adequate education?
Well, I've already started that process. With my friends and colleagues, John Tobin and Doug Hall, we held more than 70 forums around the state. It was called Ed Funding 101. It was an entirely geeky effort to explain how school funding works in New Hampshire and how grossly unfair it is. More than 3,000 people participated. We did it statewide. And from those forums, I know there's a consensus to do better. And so to do better, we have to focus on lowering the property tax for the majority of New Hampshire citizens, number one. Number two, we need to get people to pay their fair share broadly across the state. And we need to reject the rhetoric that has held us back for so, so long. The claim that we can't do a broad-based tax ignores the fact that the broadest base tax is the property tax. Everyone who lives in New Hampshire pays it. You pay it directly if you're a homeowner, indirectly if you rent. It is like a second mortgage that you can never pay off and that always goes up. And the poorer you are, the bigger the second mortgage. It's time that we made Sununu defend the fact that local property taxes went up by $320 million during his term, more than at any other time in our state's history. Mm-hmm. So if you take the pledge, you can't say what I just said.
Yeah. So when you say you want people to pay their fair share, are you talking specifically about an income tax? Those who earn more will pay more. Is that what you're saying?
No, actually, I'm not. I think there are problems with the income tax. So I don't want to pick on them, but Mitt Romney's got a $10 million estate on the lake in Wolfboro. His school taxes are about $7 a thousand. Hopkinton's school taxes are almost $21 a thousand. I'm saying Mitt Romney needs to pay his fair share. And Mitt Romney is never going to pay the income tax in New Hampshire because he doesn't live here full time and it's not where he works. So we need to have the honest conversation. There are pros and cons. I know that Dan likes to pin an income tax on me.
You're referring to Senator Dan Feltes, who's running in this race as well.
Yeah, he uses it to mimic the Republican rhetoric that happens around campaigns. The income tax is not a silver bullet. I think we need to talk about the pros and cons of the different kinds of approaches that exist, and we need to add some new ones to the table. So we need to legalize marijuana. We need to tax it. That's a revenue issue. There's a huge criminal justice aspect to that as well, but it could be a source of revenue for New Hampshire.
That pledge that we've been talking about, that's the pledge that candidates year after year have either taken or chosen not to take to veto a broad-based tax in New Hampshire, income tax. This has not worked out well in recent history for candidates who have refused to take that pledge. Why do you think this year is different? Why do you think you will succeed in your campaign while not taking that pledge, while so many others have failed historically?
Well, let's be fair on the context. First of all, the Democrats put up two pledge candidates against Chris Sununu in the last two elections, and he beat them both. There's no reason to believe that a third pledge candidate is going to do any better against Sununu. That's number one. Number two, the way to challenge Sununu is to make the clearest contrast you can and to force him to defend his over-reliance on the local property tax. If you take the pledge, you can't do that. And the third thing I'd offer is from those forums that John and Doug and I conducted, I think it's clear that people understand that what we're doing is not sustainable. There are more seniors worried about getting forced out of their homes because of the property tax now than 25 years ago at the time of Claremont. There are more schools in trouble now than at the time of Claremont. There are more working families, young families who can't get into homes now than at the time of Claremont. If we don't address this, we're going to look at our first school district bankruptcy in less than 5 years. And we're not prepared for that. The question is, do we deal with it now or do we wait for everything to absolutely blow up?
I wanted to ask you a little bit about strategies for pandemic relief. You've said that earning $600 a week in unemployment benefits during the pandemic has not been good in some cases because people were earning more than they otherwise would. Your opponent in the race, Dan Feltes, supported an extension of the $600 per week benefit. What would you propose as an alternative to the $600 per week payment?
Yeah, that's actually not what I said, Peter. That's okay. What Dan says, I said. I actually said there were unintended consequences because the $600 was made a part of the unemployment system. I actually think we should be closer to Andrew Yang's approach regarding UBI and that we should do the monetary supplements to hardworking people, but it shouldn't be part of the unemployment system. But that's a federal issue, and I'm supporting our federal delegation in fighting to get the money. What are the state issues that relate to that? Minimum wage and the cap on unemployment state benefits. So New Hampshire doesn't have a minimum wage law, which means we default to the federal abysmally low, embarrassing $7.25 an hour. That needs to be $15 an hour. New Hampshire also has the lowest cap on unemployment benefits in all of New England. It's $427 a week, no matter how much you earned before you got laid off And no matter how many dependents you have in your family, we need to increase that to 600, and we need to institute a sliding scale that accounts for the fact that you may be the breadwinner for yourself, or you may be the breadwinner for three others. Mm-hmm. Those are different circumstances, and we need to account for it.
I just want to clarify what you said and give you a chance to sort of correct the record if it's wrong. Concord Monitor reported that you said on Jack Heath's show that there were some unintended consequences to the $600 additional payment. People could earn more money by not going to work. I don't think that's a good result. Did you not say that?
I did say that. Okay. And the rest of the conversation is we should break the tie between the 600 and unemployment benefits.
Mm-hmm. On the pandemic relief and on addressing the pandemic, most of the deaths from the COVID-19 pandemic in New Hampshire have occurred at the state's long-term care facilities. What would you do as governor to protect those vulnerable residents?
What a horrible situation. You send a loved one to a long-term care facility to keep them safe, to get the kind of care they need, and it winds up being a deadly place in lots of circumstances. Part of this is resource-driven. Part of this is taking the COVID-19 virus seriously, not considering it a flu-like problem. So now there's an exploration of the air handling systems. Remember, we started with that about schools. The governor finally has his people looking at the air handling systems in affected nursing homes to figure out if there's a connection there. We should be wearing masks all across society, not just long-term care. Long-term care facilities are a part of society. The more we can shut down the virus broadly, the better off we are in and outside of long-term care facilities. So we need to be as careful as we can. We need to get good PPE to the folks working in those facilities, to the folks visiting those facilities. My friend heads the Association for Nursing Homes. He's a really big fella. And he did an expose of how the PPE, the gowns and such, were big on him, and they would not have worked with normal sized people. We need to pay attention to this problem.
So would you, if you were governor, issue a mask wearing mandate for everybody in public?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I confronted Sununu on this at the beginning of April. And his response was, public health data does not support the effectiveness of wearing a mask. That's an untrue statement. If you wear a mask, you protect your neighbors and your friends and other people in the community. There should be in place a mask order for public indoor spaces and for outdoor gatherings. And we should stick to the idea that outdoor gatherings of over a minimal size should not happen.
How would you go about enforcing that? Because Governor Sununu has said if we had a mask mandate, it would be too hard to enforce. Is it too hard to enforce in your view?
No, that's an excuse. It won't be perfect, but the public health data says if you get 4 out of 5 people to wear a mask, that has a major impact on the spread of the virus. So that's what we need, 80% compliance. If you wear a mask yourself, Governor, other people will wear it. When I go out in public, I'm wearing a mask and I'm trying to model the right behavior. We have a tent revival coming to New Ipswich, I think in 2 weeks, where people are intentionally coming to be together, not wear a mask, and then go out in communities to knock on doors and proselytize. That meeting shouldn't happen. If we had a mask order in place, New Ipswich wouldn't be placed on the spot. That's the problem of the lack of leadership by this governor.
I want to ask you some questions regarding climate and the environment. You've said that we shouldn't be building or expanding any fossil fuel infrastructure in the state. How would you fund such a quick transition off natural gas without raising costs for people?
So here's the Liberty Utilities line. Poor people can't heat their homes if we don't commit to 20 or 30 years more of fracked gas. It's a false dichotomy. We can do things. We can create affordable housing. We can create incentives for people to use solar and heat pumps. We can help people who are not of means adopt those methodologies. We don't have to commit to 20 years of expansion of fracking. Look, the choice is not, do people get to heat their homes or does the water rise and flood Seabrook and Hampton Beach? That's not what should be talked about here. There are ways for us to raise money to help people who can't afford to pay their winter heating bills in the short term, but we only have 8 or 10 years to transition away from dangerous fossil fuels like fracked gas. That's why I was so opposed to the Granite Bridge pipeline project. I might add, I'm the only candidate in this race who opposed that project. I got the same briefing that Dan received and that Sununu received. I walked away with questions and serious concerns. They walked away with checks. That was a lesson in judgment. And who can you trust to move the climate change debate forward in a way that is protective of New Hampshire and her people?
I wanted to ask you about the carbon cashback program where companies pay a fee for carbon emissions and the dividends go back to residents. Your opponent, Dan Feltes, says this isn't a priority for him. Why is it a priority for you?
Well, go back a paragraph. We don't have that much time to deal with climate change. The folks who've been working on carbon cashback have gone out to 110 communities, I think, that passed resolutions asking their representatives to support that kind of a program in the legislature. I don't think the program's perfect. I think it should and could be tweaked, but it's one of the tools that we need to deploy to get our arms around climate change and combat it. Look, I'll confess, I'm a grandfather, and I view a lot of this issue through that lens. I'm worried about the future we're leaving our children and our children's children. And I think the science is right. We're seeing it. The more powerful storms more regularly, that's climate change. The rise in the waters is climate change. The deaths in the moose population, that's climate change. It's all around us. We can't do a business as usual approach to climate change. And, you know, Sununu and his family are climate change deniers. As an executive counselor, I helped turn back, led the way turning back, three different climate change deniers appointed to important state posts by Sununu. Mm-hmm. So let's be real clear. Sununu is the biggest problem when it comes to dealing with climate change, but there's a judgment issue between Dan and me. I hate to say it, and the voters will have to make their judgment on who they trust to combat climate change.
I want to ask you this one last question really quickly, Andrew Velinsky. We're running out of time, but I did want to get your take on what you would do as governor to address systemic racism in New Hampshire.
This is a quick question, Peter.
As best as you can. We do want to get your take on this because it's really important.
Yeah, let's go quickly. So Black Lives Matter issued 7 demands about 3-4 weeks ago. I read the demands quickly and wholeheartedly endorsed them. And then I've been collaborating with them and other groups to talk about how they should go further, starting with law enforcement. We need to demilitarize and diversify law enforcement in New Hampshire, number one. Number two, Black and brown people suffer disproportionately bad healthcare outcomes. We need to build the community health center model more broadly throughout the state so that we have better access to primary and preventative care. Medicare for All is a federal issue, but hopefully eventually we'll get there. Schools, school funding is also a racial issue. Manchester is the most diverse community in terms of school children of any community in the state, yet it spends thousands less than the state average. It's the lowest spending school district in the state. But that's more than a money problem. We need to adopt curricula that is diverse in terms of ethnic, cultural, and racial concerns. And then we mm-hmm. need to recruit more Black and brown teachers and administrators to our schools so that there will be role models.
Well, Andrew Belinsky, I think we might have to leave it there, but I appreciate you taking the time to share your views with us. It's really important. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having me, Peter. More time next time.
Hope so. Executive Counselor Andrew Belinsky is running for governor in the Democratic primary scheduled for September 8th. You can find all our conversations with candidates running in that primary at nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. It's still to come. We'll be talking about polling places preparing for elections in the age of COVID-19. Are they ready? And HPR's Casey McDermott will join us. If you've got questions or comments about that, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
As a small business, we really like to support the community around us, and we feel that NHPR is a very important part of New Hampshire's community.
Lydia West of Goose Bay Lumber of Chichester is a proud NHPR underwriter.
Goose Bay is a really small business with very limited advertising dollars, but with NHPR, not only do we reach our customer base, it feels good to be able to support NHPR.
Join NHPR's growing community of underwriters at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Taking a look back at the big stories of the week, and we're joined now by Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count, a nonprofit that helps improve civic engagement in New Hampshire, and NHPR's Casey McDermott, who's helping lead NHPR's 2020 election coverage. Thanks very much to both of you for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Casey, I want to start with you because you've been covering the efforts made to prepare poll workers for the elections coming up. And so how is New Hampshire planning for safe in-person voting this year?
Well, this is going to be an election that really looks like no other that New Hampshire voters have seen in, you know, recent memory. So one of the big things that the state has done is they've said that any eligible voter can vote and register absentee due to COVID-19. So that's important to emphasize from the top. If you have concerns about going to the polls because of your health or the health of your loved ones, really for any reason at all, you can cast an absentee ballot so long as you're eligible to do so in New Hampshire. But the second part of their preparation is, really a realization that some people will still want to cast a ballot in person. And to that end, the state is doing a number of things to get its poll workers and its polling places ready for Election Day. Just this week, the state announced that they were going to be distributing thousands upon thousands of pieces of PPE, protective gear, to poll workers across the state. If people want to get a closer look at how much PPE their community is going to be receiving for Election Day, we actually put together a table that you can search online on nhpr.org. You can go to interactive, how much protective gear is your local polling place getting for the fall elections. And some of the stuff that the state is giving out, sounds like a lot of the other protective gear that's been distributed through other sectors. There's surgical masks, there's gowns, there's gloves, there's jugs of hand sanitizer. This is all happening also in the context of having to think about how those pieces of gear will interact with the voting process itself. So the state has had to issue guidance, for example, on being careful about when you use the hand sanitizer relative to when you handle the ballot.
They don't want to put wet ballots into the machines.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So the PPE is getting lined up. You can check online to see if your town's getting a lot of that. But is there anything else we should be aware of?
There is. So, I will say that there have been a number of questions that have come up. The state has been holding webinars, conference calls with poll workers of kind of various roles and responsibilities throughout the summer. And that has been, an opportunity for those local election officials to ask questions, to voice concerns about their preparations for Election Day. And there have been a number of things that have come up on those calls that have yet to be fully addressed by state officials. One of the things that's come up is election officials have over and over and over again asked the state, will you issue a requirement that people should be wearing masks? This is voters and poll workers inside of the polling place. The Secretary of State's office and actually a representative from the Attorney General's office who handles election law has said that they're not sure that they can necessarily issue that. If they did, or if the state did something like that, they said it would probably have to come from the governor's office. They said, you know, that's not to say that they will do that, that the governor will do that, but that's been their posture. But in the meantime, it is important to underscore that this is causing, you know, a great deal of anxiety for a number of poll workers. We should keep in mind that many people who we trust to run our local elections are, you know, older and in a higher risk category for coronavirus.
So there are there any efforts to recruit maybe younger people? I've heard of this nationally. I don't know if that's happening here as well.
Yep. Yeah. So that's actually something that we've reported on. We, you know, we've noted that the state is encouraging communities to reach out to younger people and even to reach out to people who are not yet old enough to vote to get them involved in the democratic process, because there are volunteer positions that are needed for running an election that do not require someone to be 18 years old. So they're saying that's a good way to get more people involved, to get younger people involved. But just to kind of get back to the question of, you know, the guidance from the state and how that's affecting preparations leading up to the election, you know, we're only a matter of weeks, just a little over a month away from the September primary. The state has not yet issued an updated election procedure manual. That's kind of the Bible of election rules and how they're implemented in New Hampshire. So that's causing a lot of concern among the local officials who still have questions about how are we going to process absentee ballots? How do I deal with this particular question from voters? How do I deal with that? Especially given that there are so many new changes and considerations due to COVID-19. And again, just to get back to your question about recruitment, some people have also said that, you know, that the lack of guidance one way or the other about the rules for example, mask usage inside of polling places is making it hard for poll workers to recruit other people to work at the polls because they can't tell those people with any level of certainty, you know, what they may be walking into on election day.
Great need for some certainty here on this. Listeners, if you have questions about something pertaining to voting, either in the primary or in the general, give us a call now. We'll try our best to answer it. The number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Casey, I don't know if you've heard of anything like this, but you know, are there any towns or cities like trying to move their polling places to a bigger space, maybe where people can spread out more?
Yeah, so there have been a number of discussions about that in recent months. My understanding is that some of that is still, you know, towns and cities are still kind of working out the best approach for them. There are some places that, for example, in past years may have had multiple polling places in their community, and these are towns. That may be like larger. We have a number of towns in New Hampshire that are larger than some of our cities. So that's just a distinction that's important to keep in mind. But for example, there are places that may have in the past had two or three polling places that are consolidating to one place, you know, for a number of reasons, but one of them being that it is, you know, it may be simpler for them to figure out how to organize and set up their polling place with all of the safety considerations that they need to take into account. And it may be easier for them to staff a single polling place in this particular era rather than staffing multiple polling places. But that really varies community by community. The best thing that people should do is get in touch with their local city or town clerk. The Secretary of State's website has a directory where you can put in where you live, and it will you know, take you to the contact information for your local election official. That's really a good way to stay up to date about what's happening in your part of New Hampshire, because it really does vary town by town.
Well, Anna Brown, let's talk a little bit about absentee ballots. What about folks who want to avoid in-person voting altogether? Casey said that, you know, if, because of COVID-19, any eligible voter can request an absentee ballot. What's the general sentiment around absentee ballots in New Hampshire?
Sure. So there has been, of course, a lot of debate about the concept of mail-in voting versus absentee ballots. President Trump made a now somewhat infamous tweet recently saying that mail-in voting causes fraud as opposed to absentee ballots are good. And so should we delay the election? And of course, let's remember that that would require an act of Congress. And Governor Sununu has said explicitly, we will not be moving the election. So in New Hampshire, we don't have widespread mail-in voting, which might mean everybody gets a ballot in the mail. But anybody can apply for an absentee ballot this year, specifically because of the coronavirus. So anyone who's looking to do that should contact their town clerk. And Governor Sununu recently signed a law that you only have to fill out one form to request a ballot for both the primary and general election. Usually you'd have to file a request for both the primary and then again for the general, because you might be gone one day or not the other. So at that point, you can get a ballot mailed to you. You'll fill it out, and you will mail it back to your town clerk. And as once again, this is another sort of new territory for towns that they are having to deal with and cities, because they are anticipating that they are going to get a lot more ballots mailed in than usual. And so that same bill that allowed people to request the primary and general ballot absentee at the same time also made some other changes to the absentee ballot process that will allow for some earlier processing. They're very careful around how you process absentee ballots. There has to be signature matching. You can't look at the ballots too early because you don't want to influence votes or anything like that. But they're going to allow them to start sort of processing those envelopes a little earlier.
And let's go to the phones and take a call from Kristen and Keene. Kristen, thank you very much for calling. What's your question?
Hi, good morning. I have a couple just quick questions. One is, if you choose to get an absentee ballot, can you change your mind and not use it and go and vote in person that day? Or does that confuse the whole system? That's the first question. And then the second question, are there any polling places in our state where people can just sort of do a drive-through and put their absentee ballot through the machine? So it's kind of like, instead of drive-through graduation, you're doing a drive-through vote. So you really feel like you've accomplished and actually got your ballot in, and it didn't just go off in the mail somewhere and disappear.
Okay, two-part question. Thank you, Kristen. Casey, any thoughts on if you get an absentee ballot but say, never mind, I want to do it in person, can you do that?
You can, actually. So that's actually an important point to emphasize, is that, you know, first of all, New Hampshire has had absentee voting for a long time. So it's not necessarily a new process. It's just likely to have to be implemented on a wider scale this year. But part of the process also offers someone the opportunity, if for whatever reason you don't want to send your absentee application in the mail, or you don't want to, even send your ballot in the mail. If your town hall or city hall is open right now, this is another good reminder to check in with your local clerk, because you could potentially show up at your local city or town hall, apply for your absentee ballot. If, you know, the clerk deems you eligible on the spot, you could potentially fill out and submit your absentee ballot in person. So that would, that would be a way to submit your vote and have it in without having to worry about, the process of kind of sending it in the mail or doing it in another way. The other thing that the caller asked about was drive up voting. We saw a number of communities actually kind of pilot that in the spring, because there were local elections that had to take place during the pandemic. And that seems to have worked well for a number of those communities that tried it. The thing to keep in mind is that turnout in a state primary and a general election is usually a lot higher than those local elections. So even just from kind of a traffic logistic perspective, that adds another layer of planning to making that work. The state also, this is another area of, questions that local election officials have been actually asking for more clarity on from state election officials is this idea of drive-up voting or some, you know, similar iteration of it. The state hasn't issued definitive guidance on that yet, so that's something that we should definitely keep an eye out for to see if there's anything else offered to that end in the weeks ahead. One other thing that I did just want to come back to,
sure,
on the subject of absentee voting, there is an important change that people should keep in mind. And I know this has been causing some confusion for people based on the kind of language that's on the absentee ballot paperwork. But New Hampshire actually does not have a signature matching requirement for its absentee voting system. That was the subject of a lawsuit and some legislation in the last few years. And there is some language on the absentee paperwork that is actually struck out that alludes to that signature matching requirement. But the Secretary of State's office says that they are not going to be comparing, for example, someone's handwriting on their absentee ballot versus the paperwork that they submitted to apply for that absentee ballot, because you know, there was a court case that said that that was kind of too inconsistent and too arbitrary a system for determining whether or not someone's vote should count.
So what is the system for security? If you're a state official and you get someone's ballot mailed in, how can you be sure that the person who claims to be mailing this in is actually the person who filled in the ballot?
Well, first of all, you know, someone attests under, you know, under penalty of perjury that they are who they say they are. So that's one level of security that's in the system. The other level, though, is that the state has said that people, you know, should still submit proof that they are, you know, that they are who they say they are, that they are eligible to vote in the community that they're eligible to vote in. So there are ways to look at the absentee application materials that someone is asked to show, whether they are asking for their absentee ballot in person or whether they are sending that, you know, sending those materials through other means. There are checks in the system to provide some level of, you know, security. And again, just to reinforce, I know there's been a lot of talk about, you know, allusions to the security or the integrity of the absentee ballot system. This is a system that people have been using for decades. So this is a system that has checks and balances built into it. And, you know, there is really no evidence of widespread voter fraud in the absentee ballot system. And that's, you know, election officials themselves are telling people to, you know, feel confident in the security of the absentee voting procedures that they've put in place to protect people's safety this year.
Well, Anna Brown, I wanted to ask you about some of the uncontested candidates running next month. Are there many of those? And what might that mean for turnout? I mean, if someone is running uncontested for an office, it might not fire voters up.
Sure. So this is actually a consistent problem in New Hampshire. And so it's interesting because we talk about the difficulty of finding poll workers. In some ways, there's actually also a difficulty finding enough candidates to get on the ballot. This is particularly a problem with the state house because there's 400 representatives, 204 districts. And so you're going in the primary, about 13% of races have a contested Democratic primary, which means that there's more Democrats running than there are seats, and only about 15% have a contested Republican primary. That's not too different than 2018, when it was also about 15% contested. So those races are interesting insofar as lots of time the battle just took place to get candidates on the ballot. And I think that, you know, both the Democrats and Republicans have said, you know, oh, we have more candidates than ever. And that's true. They have slightly more candidates running, but you're not going to see a lot more contested races in many of those districts. I did also just want to jump in one other thing about
sure.
election security and absentee ballots. One other controversy that got debated this year is the Secretary of State participates in the Kansas-based Interstate Voter Registration Cross-Check Program, which is a way to compare voters across state lines. And that's how the Secretary of State and the Attorney General's office ended up prosecuting some people who voted absentee in one state and in person in New Hampshire or vice versa. This year, the legislature did try to pass a bill that would have repealed participation in that program and had the Secretary of State participate in a different one, the Electronic Information Center, to share voter information. That got vetoed. So it's, you know, there's a lot of complexity around that issue, but there is also that other system that is in place to check that voters are not voting absentee and voting in person.
One more thing to talk to you about, Anna, before we let you go, and that's that Governor Sununu last week said that there would be $1.5 million added to New Hampshire's education scholarship organizations. He said those scholarships are helping Black students and students of color, but why are Democrats criticizing this move?
Certainly. So that $1.5 million came out of the general roughly $1 billion that New Hampshire got to spend on anything coronavirus related. And so far, Governor Sununu has not dedicated any of that specifically to private schools or public schools, because there was a whole separate part of the CARES Act funds that was just for schools in general. So the problem that Democrats are seeing is that when you look at how much public schools are getting from that CARES Act funding, it's a lot less per student than is going to happen with this $1.5 million scholarship. So they say, okay, instead of setting aside some of this money for private school scholarships, we need to help public schools more. They're looking at reopening with a lot of anxiety and a lot of challenges, and that money could go to PPE, improving air circulation in the schools, you know, whatever the HVAC systems are, working on remote learning or providing laptops to students. However, of course, $1.5 million is still significantly less than the roughly $34 million that the Federal Department of Education is giving to public schools. In terms of whether this is going to help low-income students and students of color, it's going into a program that does help students that are low-income. A certain percentage of these scholarships do have to go to low-income students. But it's also worth keeping in mind that the average tuition at a private school in New Hampshire is probably around $10,000. And the maximum amount for these scholarships in the past has been a few thousand dollars tops. So it can still be really hard for low-income students to even afford a private school, even with this scholarship.
That's Anna Brown. She is Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count, a nonprofit that helps improve civic engagement here in New Hampshire. Thank you very much, Anna, for being on the program. Really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure.
We've also heard from NHPR's Casey McDermott, who's helping to lead our 2020 election coverage. Thank you very much, Casey. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Peter.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. And still to come, we'll speak to NHPR's Daniela Ali about the reopening of New Hampshire's colleges and universities. If you've got questions about that, you can email exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call now. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're taking a look back at the week's news on the program today. And just this quick note on the previous segment, we mentioned the voter cross-check program, which was designed to make sure that, for example, people don't vote in two states in the same election. This program was suspended, quote, for the foreseeable future in 2019 after it came under scrutiny for its efficacy and security practices. So we will update you if that happens to change, but we did want to clarify that point. If you have questions or comments about school reopening, particularly university reopening in the fall, give us a call now. That's our next topic, 1-800-892-6477. And with us now is NHPR's Daniela Ali, who has covered the decision to reopen New Hampshire universities made earlier this week. Daniela, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
So what do these reopening plans mean for students this fall? What does a socially distanced university look like?
Right. So you're going to see a lot of folks wearing masks, even in classrooms, you know, desks being 6 feet apart, more of a takeout style or quick service dining options, or even more limited seating in dining areas, for example. In the case of Keene State, dorms will also be adjusted for example, they will only have maximum of two people to a room. They won't have triples or quads. So you, and in some cases too, it's a resident only policy for those dorms. So basically like no outside visitors will be allowed, within those dormitories. So, you know, it's going to be a very different year for students who will be attending colleges in the university system of New Hampshire.
And before they come back, are students required to get a negative test proving that they have not contracted COVID-19?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. So all colleges are requiring students to be tested prior to arriving on campus and providing proof of a negative test. And many of these colleges are coordinating with either convenient MD or Quest to have those students tested, or, you know, to help students find a way to get tested and have those results in time before they arrive on campus. And many these colleges are also, you know, paying for these tests so that students can have them done before they get to campus. And, you know, colleges will also be testing students when they arrive on campus. So, you know, at least twice in the first 2 weeks, students will be tested, and then there will be testing throughout the semester.
Last week, you reported that students have concerns about the consent agreement that the UNH system wanted them to sign. Can you tell us a little bit about this consent agreement and why students may not have liked it?
Yeah, so the consent agreement, you know, included policies, procedures that students were being asked to follow. So kind of, you know, here's what we're expecting from you in terms of wearing your mask, in terms of social distancing. But students were pretty concerned because at least some students were pretty concerned because there was also an ask there of that if you signed this and you were assuming the risk of being on campus, including, you know, the potential to contract COVID-19. And so students were really wondering, what does that mean if I'm assuming the risk, and what are the risks of being on campus? So students had, you know, a lot of questions around that and just around the protocols that would be followed and, you know, how things would be enforced. So, you know, there was, and they asked for an extension in mid-July to have more time to think through this and have some time to have some of their questions answered. Some students put all their questions in a Google Doc that is about 143 questions long. So that ranges from like accommodations to testing to cleaning to all sorts of things that people want to have some more clarity on in, you know, heading to a campus this fall in New Hampshire.
And if students just simply refuse to sign this agreement, are they not allowed to go to school, or can they go to school remotely?
So if they would have to go to school remotely, so they wouldn't be allowed on, they to be on campus, you have to sign and agree to the agreement, basically. So if you don't sign it, then there is the option to take online classes, but not every single class has that online option as well. So there might need to be some adjusting in a student schedule.
I want to ask you about testing. You mentioned universities plan to test students even once they come back. What's that going to look like? Are there going to be test sites set up in, you know, student centers or outside and in public places? What's it going to look like, testing during the semester?
That's a good question. I still need to nail down the details on how they will be doing that. I think it'll take, it'll happen over the course of a week. So students will, that's still something I need to figure out, is like where exactly those tests will be happening.
I bet it's on that list of 143 something questions that the students have as well.
Yeah.
Do the universities have a contingency plan in case they need to transition back to fully remote learning?
Yeah, so they're kind of talking about like a trigger point, basically, right? Like, at what point would we need to go back to remote learning? So in each college campus has a couple beds for like quarantine beds, basically, in the case that students are infected. So at UNH, for example, like if the capacity, they have about 300 quarantine beds for students if the case of infection. So if the capacity there is close to 50%, according to the plans from the university, a decision would be made to transition to non-face-to-face learning. So going remote. And so there's kind of a different level for each college on like restricted or limited or remote learning, pending on what the situation is on campus and also what the situation is, you know, in the community too. So people have their plans and will adjust, you know, according to how things play out.
And what about schools that aren't in the UNH system? What about Dartmouth, for example?
Yeah, so Dartmouth has a pretty stringent first week of testing. So they're also requiring students to, at least when they arrive on campus, they'll be tested on the very first day, on the third day, and the seventh day that they are on campus. And pending on those test results of each of those days, you will have more ability to move around the campus. And basically Dartmouth is asking students to kind of quarantine for 14 days, basically, to make sure that there isn't, you know, that potential community spread. And so they're doing, you know, basically in the first week of students' arrival, they'll have done 6,000 tests. They're also staggering the arrival of students over the course of several days. And they will be testing, you know, throughout the quarter as well. And for Dartmouth, they have a couple of classes online in person, but the majority of classes will be remote, even for students who are on campus.
NHPR's Danielle Ali, thank you very much for bringing us up to speed on this. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
And that's it for the roundup today. I want to thank all our guests for being on the program, including NHPR's Casey McDermott, Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, and earlier in the program, Andrew Valinsky, Executive Counselor and Democrat running in this year's gubernatorial primary. The show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Michael Brindley is our program manager, and Jane Vaughn is the production fellow for The Exchange, and our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Remember, the conversation continues online. You can find a link to all the stories that we talked about today at nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.